The night was cool enough to send a small shiver through Perrin whenever the breeze gusted despite his fur-lined cloak. A halo around the fat crescent moon said there would be more rain before long. Thick clouds drifting across the moon made the pale light dim and strengthen, yet it was enough for his eyes. He sat stepper just inside the edge of the trees and watched the cluster of four tall greystone windmills in a clearing atop the ridge, their pale sails gleaming and shadowed by turns as they rotated. The machinery of the windmills groaned loudly. It seemed doubtful the Shido even knew they should grease the works of the things. The stone aqueduct was a dark bar stretching east on high stone arches, past abandoned farms and rail-fenced fields the Shido had planted too early with this much rain, toward another ridge and the lake beyond. Malden lay one more ridge west. He eased the heavy hammer in its loop on his belt. Malden and Fael. In a few hours, he would add a 54th knot to the leather cord in his pocket. He cast his mind out. "Are you ready, Snowy Dawn?" he thought. "Are you close enough yet?" Wolves avoided towns, and with Shido hunting parties in the surrounding forest during the day, they stayed further from Malden than usual. "Patience, young bull," came the reply, touched with irritation. But then Snowy Dawn was irascible by nature, a scarred male of considerable age for a wolf who had once killed a leopard by himself. Those old injuries sometimes kept him from sleeping very long at a stretch. "2 days from now," you said, "we will be there. Now let me try to sleep. We must hunt well tomorrow, since we cannot hunt the day after." They were images and smells, rather than words, of course. 2 days was the sun crossing the sky twice, and hunt, a pack trotting with noses into the breeze, blended with the scent of deer. But Perrin's mind converted the images to words even as he saw them in his head. Patience, yes. Haste spoiled the work. But it was hard now that he was so close, very hard. A form appeared from the dark door at the base of the nearest windmill and waved an Aiel spear back and forth overhead. The groaning had convinced him the windmills must still be deserted. They had been when the maidens scouted them earlier, and no one would put up with that noise any longer than they had to. But he had sent Gaul and some of the maidens to be sure one way or another. "Let's go, Mishima," he said, gathering his reins. "It's done. One way or another."
"How can you make out anything?" the Shan Chan muttered.
He avoided looking at Perrin, whose golden eyes would be glowing in the night. That had made the scarred man jump the first time he saw it. He did not smell amused tonight. He smelled tense. But he called softly over his shoulder.
"Bring the carts ahead. Quickly now, quickly. And be quiet about it, or I'll have your ears."
Perrin heeled his dun stallion forward without waiting on the others, or the 6 high-wheeled carts. Liberally greased axles made them as quiet as carts could be. They still sounded noisy to him, the cart horses' hooves squelching in the mud, the carts themselves creaking as wood flexed and rubbed, but he doubted anyone else could have heard them 50 paces off, and maybe not closer. At the top of the gentle slope, he dismounted and let Stepper's reins fall. A trained warhorse, the stallion would stand there as if hobbled so long as his reins hung down. The windmill heads squealed, turning slightly as the breeze shifted. The slowly spinning arms were long enough that Perrin could have touched one by jumping when it swung low. He stared toward the last ridge that hid Malden. Nothing grew there taller than a bush. Nothing moved in the darkness. Just one ridge between him and Fael. The maidens had come outside to join Gaul, all of them still veiled.
"There was no one," Gaul said, not quietly.
This close, the grinding of the windmill's gears would have swallowed quiet words.
The dust has not been disturbed since I was here last, Sulin added.
Perrin scratched his beard, just as well. Had they needed to kill Shido, they could have carried away the bodies, but the dead would have been missed, and it would have drawn attention to the windmills and aqueduct. It might have started someone thinking about the water.
Help me get the lids off, Gaul.
There was no need for him to do that. It would save only minutes, but he needed to be doing something. Gaul simply stuck his spear through the harness holding his bowcase to join the others on his back. The aqueduct ran along the ground on the ridgetop between the four windmills and stood shoulder-high on Perrin, less on Gaul, who climbed over. Just beyond the last pair of windmills, bronze handles on either side allowed them to lift off heavy pieces of stone 2 feet wide and 5 feet long until they cleared a stretch of 6 feet. What the opening was used for, he did not know. There was another like it on the other side, maybe to work on the flaps that made sure water flowed only one way, or to get inside to repair any leaks. He could see small ripples of motion as it streamed toward Malden, filling more than half the stone channel. Mishima joined them and dismounted to stand peering uncertainly at Sulin and the maidens. He probably believed the night hid his expression. He smelled wary now. He was followed quickly by the first of the red-coated Shonchan soldiers, scrambling up the muddy slope, each carrying two middling-sized jute sacks. Middling, but not heavy. Each contained only 10 pounds. Eyeing the Aiel suspiciously, the wiry woman set her sacks down and slashed one open with her dagger. A handful of fine, dark grains spilled on the muddy ground.
"Do that over the opening," Perrin said. "Make sure every grain goes into the water."
The wiry woman looked to Mishima, who said firmly,
"Do as Lord Perrin commands, Arata."
Perrin watched as she emptied the sack into the aqueduct, hands lifted over her head. The dark grains floated away toward Malden. He had dropped a pinch into a cup of water, hating to waste even that, and they took some time to absorb enough water to sink. Long enough to reach the big cistern in the town, he hoped. And if not, they could steep in the aqueduct itself. The cistern would still turn to forkroot tea eventually. The light send it would be strong enough. With luck, maybe even strong enough to affect the Algaid Siswai. The wise ones who could channel were his target, but he would take any advantage he could gain. The light send it did not grow strong faster than he expected. If those wise ones began staggering too soon, they might puzzle out the cause before he was ready. But all he could do was go ahead as if he knew exactly. That and pray. By the time the second sack was being poured into the stone channel, the others began crowding up the slope. First came Sionid, a short woman holding her dark divided skirts up out of the mud. Shifting his attention from the maidens to her, Mishima made one of those small gestures to ward off evil. Strange that they could believe a thing like that worked. The soldiers lined up with their sacks stared at her, wide-eyed for the most part, and shifted their feet. The Shonchan were none too easy about working with Aes Sedai. Her warders, Furin and Terrell, were at her heels, each with a hand resting on his sword hilt. They were just as easy about the Shonchan. The one was dark with gray streaking his curly black beard, the other fair and young with curled mustaches, yet they were alike as two beans, tall, lean, and hard. Rover Kirklin came a little behind them, a compact man with dark receding hair and a glum expression. He did not like being separated from Missouri. All three of the men had small bundles containing food strapped to their backs and fat waterskins hanging from their shoulders. A lanky man rested his sacks on the side of the opening as the wiry woman headed downslope to fetch more. The carts were piled high with them.
"Remember," Perrin told Sionid, "the biggest danger will be getting from the cistern to the fortress. You'll have to use the guard walk on the wall, and there might be Shido in the town even at this hour."
Alice had seemed unsure on that. Thunder boomed hollowly in the distance, then again.
"Maybe you'll have rain to hide you."
"Thank you," she said icily.
Her moon-shadowed face was a mask of Aes Sedai serenity, but her scent spiked with indignation. "I would not have known any of that if you had not told me." The next moment her expression softened and she laid a hand on his arm. "I know you are worried about her. We will do what can be done." Her tone was not exactly warm, it never was, but not so chill as before, and her scent had mellowed to sympathy. Turl lifted her up onto the edge of the aqueduct. The Shanchen emptying fork root into the thing, a tall fellow with almost as many scars as Mishima, nearly dropped his sack. And she grimaced faintly before swinging her legs over and lowering herself into the water with a small gasp. It must have been cold. Ducking her head, she moved out of sight toward Malden. Furin climbed in after her, then Terrell, and finally Rovere. They had to bend sharply to fit under the roof of the aqueduct. Elias clapped Perrin on the shoulder before hoisting himself up.
"Should have trimmed my beard short like yours to keep it out of that," he said, gazing down at the water.
That graying beard, ruffled by the breeze, spread across his chest. For that matter, his hair, gathered at the back of his neck with a leather cord, hung to his waist. He carried a small bundle of food and a water skin, too.
"Still, a cold bath helps a man keep his mind off his troubles."
"I thought that was for keeping your mind off women," Perrin said. He was in no mood for joking, but he could not expect everyone to be as grim as he was. Elias laughed.
"What else causes a man's troubles?"
He disappeared into the water, and Talanvor replaced him. Perrin caught his dark coat sleeve. "No heroics, mind." He had been of two minds about letting the man be part of this.
"No heroics, my lord," Talanvor agreed.
For the first time in a long time, he looked eager. The smell of him quivered with eagerness, but there was an edge of caution in it, too. That caution was the only reason he was not back in their camp.
"I won't put Megden at risk, or the Lady Fael. I just want to see Megden that much quicker."
Perrin nodded and let him go. He could understand that. Part of him wanted to climb into the aqueduct, too, to see Fael again that much quicker. But every piece of the work had to be done properly, and he had other tasks. Besides, if he were actually inside Malden, he was not sure how he could restrain himself from trying to find her. He could not catch his own scent, of course, but he doubted there was any caution in it now. The windmill heads turned again with loud squeaks as the wind shifted back. At least it never seemed to die up here. Any stoppage of the water flow would be disastrous. The ridgetop was becoming crowded now. 20 of Fael's hangers-on were waiting their turn at the aqueduct, all that remained save the two who were spying on Mesima. The women wore men's coats and breeches and had their hair cut short except for a tail at the back in imitation of the Aiel, though no Aiel would have worn sword as they did. Many of the Tyran men had shaved their beards because Aiel did not wear them. Behind them, 50 Two Rivers men carried halberds and unstrung bows, their bowstrings safely tucked away inside their coats, and each with three bristling quivers tied to his back along with a parcel of food. Every man in the camp had volunteered for this, and Perrin had had to let them choose lots. He had considering doubling the number or more. Hangers-on and Two Riversmen had their bundles of food and their water skins. The constant flow of Shanchen soldiers continued, carrying full sacks up the slope and empty sacks back down. They were disciplined. When a man slipped in the mud and fell, as happened with some regularity, there was no cursing or even mutters. They just got up and went ahead. Salon de Derengil, wearing a dark coat with six horizontal stripes of color across the chest, stopped to offer Perrin her hand. She only came up to his chest, but Elias claimed she handled the sword at her hip credibly. Perrin no longer thought she and the others were fools. Well, not all the time, in spite of their attempts to copy Aiel ways. With differences, of course. The tail of dark hair at Salanda's nape was tied with a length of dark ribbon. There was no fear in her scent, only determination.
"Thank you for allowing us to be part of this, my lord," she said in precise Kyrianan accent. "We will not let you down, or the Lady Fael."
"I know you won't," he said, shaking her hand. There had been a time when she had been pointed about serving Fael and not him. He shook the hand of every one of them before they climbed into the aqueduct. They all smelled determined. So did Ban Alcine, who commanded the two riversmen going into Maldon.
When Fael and the others come, wedge the outer doors shut, Ban.
Perrin had told him this before, but he could not help repeating himself.
Then see if you can get them back up the aqueduct.
That fortress had not kept the Shido out the first time, and if anything went wrong, he doubted it would keep them out this time either. He did not mean to renege on his bargain with the Shan Chan. The Shido were going to pay for what they had done to Fael, and besides, he could not leave them behind to continue ravaging the countryside. But he wanted her out of harm's way as soon as possible. Ban propped his bow stave and halberd against the aqueduct and hoisted himself up to reach a hand down inside. When he lowered himself back to the ground, he wiped his damp hand on his coat, then rubbed the side of his prominent nose.
Below the water, it's coated with something feels like pond slime. We're going to have a hard enough time getting down that last slope without sliding the whole way, Lord Perrin, much less trying to climb it again. I expect the best thing is to wait in that fortress till you reach us.
Perrin sighed. He had thought of sending ropes, but they would have needed nearly 2 miles of it to span that last slope. A lot to be carried, and if any Shido spotted the butt end of it in the Maldon end of the aqueduct, they would search every nook and cranny in the town. A small risk, perhaps, yet the bitter loss that might result made it loom large.
I'll be there as fast as I can, Ban. I promise you that.
He shook hands with every one of them, too. Lantern-jawed Todd Elkar, and Leof Torfin, with a white streak through his hair where a scar ran, given to him by Trollocs. Young Kenley Merrin, who was making a stab at growing a beard again, unfortunately. And Billy Adara, who was almost as white as Perrin, if a hand shorter. Billy was a distant cousin, and some of the closest kin Perrin had living. He had grown up with many of these men, though some were a few years older than he. Some were a few years younger, too. By now, he knew the men from down to Devon Ride and up to Watch Hill as well as he did those from around Emmons Field. He had more reason than Fael alone to reach that fortress as fast as he could. Had Alora, a lean fellow with thick mustaches like a Terrabanner, was the last of the Two Rivers men. As he climbed into the aqueduct, Gaul appeared, face still veiled and 4 spears gripped in the hand that held his bullhide buckler. He put a hand on the edge of the aqueduct and leapt up to sit on the stone coping.
"You're going in?" Perrin said in surprise. "The maidens can do any scouting you need, Perrin Ibarra."
The big Aiel glanced over his shoulder toward the maidens. Perrin thought he scowled, though it was hard to be sure because of the black veil that hid all but his eyes.
"I heard them talking when they thought I was not listening. Unlike your wife and the others, Chiad is properly Gai Shine. Bane, too, but I care nothing about her." Chiad still has the rest of her year and a day to serve after we rescue her. When a man has a woman as Gai Shine or a woman a man, sometimes a marriage wreath is made as soon as white is put off. It is not uncommon. But I heard the maidens say they would reach Chiad first, to keep her from me.
Behind him, Sulin's finger flashed in maiden hand talk, and one of the others slapped a hand over her mouth as if stifling laughter. So they had been goading him. Maybe they were not so hard against his suit for Chiad as they pretended. Or maybe there was something Perrin was missing. Aiel humor could be rough. Gaul slipped into the water. He had to bend almost parallel to the surface to get under the aqueduct's top. Perrin stared at the opening. So easy to follow, Gaul. Turning away was hard. The line of Seanchan soldiers still snaked up and down the slope.
"Mishima, I'm going back to my camp. Gritty will take you to yours when you're done here. Do what you can to blur the tracks before you go."
"Very well, my lord. I've told off some men to scrape grease from the axles and grease these windmills. They sound as if they could seize up any minute. We can do those at the far ridge, too."
Taking up Stepper's reins, Perrin looked up at the slow-turning sails. Slow but steady. They had never been made to turn fast.
"And if Shido decide to come out here tomorrow and wonder where the fresh grease came from?"
Mishima regarded him for a long moment, his face half hidden by moon shadows. For once, he did not seem put off by glowing yellow eyes. His scent... he smelled as if he saw something unexpected.
"The Banner General was right about you," he said slowly.
"What did she say?"
"You'll have to ask her, my lord."
Perrin rode down the slope and back to the trees, thinking how easy it would be to turn around. Galen could handle everything from here. It was all laid out. Except that the Mayenner believed every battle climaxed with a grand charge of horse. And preferably began with one, too. How long would he stick to the plan? Arganda was more sensible, but he was so anxious for Queen Aleandra that he might well order that charge as well. That left himself. The breeze gusted hard, and he pulled his cloak around him. Grady, elbows on his knees, was in a small clearing, sitting on a half-worked mossy stone that was partially sunken into the ground, and no doubt left over from building the aqueduct. A few others like it stood around. The breeze kept his scent from Perrin's nose. He did not look up until Perrin drew rein in front of him. The gateway they had used to come here still stood open, showing another clearing among tall trees, not far from where the Seanchan were now camped. It might have been easier to have had them set up close to Perrin's camp, but he wanted to keep the Aes Sedai and Wise Ones as far from the Suldam and Damani as possible. He was not afraid of the Seanchan breaking Ty Lee's word, but the Aes Sedai and Wise Ones practically came down with the pip just thinking about Damani. Probably the Wise Ones and Anura would stay their hands for the time being. Probably. Masuri, he was not so sure of, in a number of ways. Better to keep a few leagues between them for as long as it could be managed.
"Are you all right, Grady?"
The man's weathered face seemed to have new lines in it. That might have been a trick of moonshadows cast by the trees, but Perrin did not think so. The carts had passed through the gateway easily, but was it a little smaller than the first he had seen Grady make?
"Just a little tired, my lord," Grady said wearily.
He remained seated with his elbows on his knees.
"All this traveling we've been doing lately. Well, I couldn't have held the gateway open long enough for all those soldiers to ride through yesterday. That's why I've taken to tying them off."
Perrin nodded. Both of the Ashaman were tired. Channeling took strength out of a man as surely as swinging a hammer all day at a forge. More so, in truth. The man with the hammer could keep going far longer than any Ashaman. That was why the aqueduct was the route into Maldon and not a gateway. Why there would be no gateway to bring Fael and the others out again, much as Perrin wished there could be. The two Ashaman only had so much more left in them until they could rest, and that little had to be used where it was needed most. Light, but that was a hard thought. Only if Grady Arnialde fell one gateway short of what was needed, a lot of men were going to die. A hard decision.
"I'm going to need you and Nialde the day after tomorrow."
That was like saying he needed air. Without the Ashaman, everything became impossible.
"You're going to be busy then."
Another gross understatement.
"Busy as a one-armed man plastering a ceiling, my lord."
"Are you up to it?"
"Have to be, don't I, my lord?"
Perrin nodded again. "You did what had to be done."
"Send me back to our camp. After you return Mishima and his people to his, you and the maidens can sleep there if you'd like."
That would spare Grady a little against 2 days from now.
"Don't know about the maidens, my lord, but I'd as soon come on home tonight."
He turned his head to look at the gateway without rising, and it dwindled in the reverse of how it had opened. The view through it seemed to rotate as it narrowed, finishing with a vertical slash of silvery blue light that left a faint purplish bar in Perrin's vision when it winked out.
"Those Damani fair make my skin crawl. They don't want to be free."
"How would you know that?"
"I talked to some of them when none of those Suldam was close by. Soon as I brought up maybe they'd like those leashes off, just hinting-like, they started screaming for the Suldam. The Damani were crying and the Suldam petting them and stroking them and glaring daggers at me. Fair made my skin crawl."
Stepper stamped an impatient hoof, and Perrin patted the stallion's neck. Grady was lucky though Suldam had let him go with a whole hide.
Whatever happens with the Damani, Grady, it won't be this week or next, and it won't be us who fixes it. So you let the Damani be. We have a job of work in front of us that needs doing.
And a deal with the Dark One to do it. He pushed the thought away. Anyway, it had grown hard to think of Tali Kirgan being on the Dark One's side, or Mishima.
You understand that?
I understand, my lord. I'm just saying it makes my skin crawl.
At last another silvery-blue slash appeared, widening into an opening that showed a clearing among large, widely spaced trees and a low stone outcrop. Leaning low on Stepper's neck, Perrin rode through. The gateway winked out behind him, and he rode on through the trees until he came to the large clearing where the camp lay, near what had once been the tiny village of Britain, a collection of flea-riddled hovels that the most rain-soaked night could not tempt a man into. The sentries up in the trees gave no warnings, of course. They recognized him. He wanted nothing so much as he wanted his blankets right then. Well, Fael, certainly, but lacking her, he wanted to be alone in the dark. Likely he would fail to find sleep again, but he would spend the night, as he had so often before, thinking of her, remembering her. Short of the 10-pace-wide thicket of sharpened stakes that surrounded the camp, though, he reined in. A rockin was crouched just outside the stakes, its long gray neck lowered so a woman in a hooded brown coat could scratch its leathery snout. Her hood hung down her back, revealing short-cropped hair and a hard, narrow face. She looked at Perrin as if she recognized him, but went right on scratching. The saddle on the creature's back had places for two riders. A messenger had come, it seemed. He turned into one of the narrow, angled lanes, through the stakes that had been left to allow horses through. Just not quickly. Most everybody had turned in already. He sensed movement on the horse lines, in the heart of the camp, likely some of the Kyrianan grooms or farriers, but the patched canvas tents and small huts of woven evergreen branches, now long since brown, lay dark and quiet. Nothing moved among the low Aiel tents, and only a few sentries walking up and down in the nearest Mayenner section of the camp. The Mayenners and Gael Danan put little trust in the Two Rivers men in the trees. His tall, red-striped tent was alight, however, and the shadows of a number of people shifted on the tent walls. When he climbed down in front of the tent, Athan Chandin appeared to take the reins and knuckle his forehead while he hunched a sort of bow. Athan was a good bow shot, or he would not have been here, but he had a truckling manner. Perrin went in unpinning his cloak.
"There you are,"
Berylaine said brightly. She must have dressed hastily because her long black hair looked as though it had just had a lick and a promise from a brush, but her high-necked gray riding dress appeared neat and fresh. Her serving women never let her don anything unless it was freshly ironed. She held out a silver wine cup for Brianna to refill from a long-necked wine pitcher, which the Kyrianan woman did with a grimace. Fael's maid disliked Berylaine with a passion. Berylaine seemed not to notice, though.
"Forgive me for entertaining in your tent, but the Banner General wanted to see you, and I thought I'd keep her company. She's been telling us about some white cloaks."
Balwer was standing unobtrusively in a corner. The bird-like little man could be as unnoticeable as a lizard on a branch when he wished to be, but his scent sharpened at the mention of white cloaks. Ty Lee, her shoulders straining a coat like that of the flyer, made a straight-legged bow while keeping one eye on Nora. She seemed to believe that Aes Sedai might turn into ravening wild dogs at any moment. Perrin thought she smelled of distress, though none showed on her dark face.
"My lord, I have two pieces of news I felt I had to bring you immediately. Have you begun putting the fork root into the town's water?"
"I have," he said worriedly, tossing his cloak down atop one of the brass-banded chests. Ty Lee sighed.
"I told you I would. I'd have done it 2 days ago if that fool woman in Almazar hadn't dragged her heels so. What's happened?"
"Forgive me," Linny announced, "but I was roused from my blankets, and I would like to return to them.
Does anyone require anything else of me tonight?"
There were no curtsies or milords from the frail-appearing woman with her white hair and a loose braid for sleeping. Unlike with Berylaine, her brown dress looked hastily donned, unusual for her. Her scent was crisp and sharp with disapproval. She was one of those who believed the ridiculous tale that Perrin had slept with Berylaine on the very night after Fael had been captured. She managed to avoid looking at him while her gaze swept around the tent's interior. "I'll have some more wine," Aram announced, holding out his cup. Grim-faced and haggard in a red-striped coat, his eyes hollow, he was attempting to lounge in one of the folding camp chairs, but the sword strapped to his back made leaning against the gilt-edged back impossible. Brianna started toward him.
"He's had enough," Linny said sharply, and Brianna turned away.
Linny had a firm hand with Fael's servants. Aram muttered an oath and leaped to his feet, tossing his cup down on the flowered carpet that served as a floor.
"I might as well go somewhere I won't have some old woman nagging at me every time I take a drink."
He gave Perrin a sullen glare before stalking out of the tent, doubtless on his way to Massima's camp. He had pleaded to be one of the party sent into Malden, but his hot head could not be trusted with that.
"You can go, Linny," Berylaine said. "Brianna can look after us well enough."
A snort was the acknowledgement Linny gave. She made it sound almost delicate, before she stalked out, stiff-backed and reeking of disapproval. And still not looking at Perrin.
"Forgive me, my lord," Tylee drawled in careful tones, "but you seem to run your household more loosely than I'm accustomed to." "It's our way, Banner General," Perrin said, picking up Aram's cup. "No need to dirty another. Nobody around here is property."
If that sounded sharp, so be it. He had come to like Tylee after a fashion, but these Seanchan had ways that would make a goat gag. He took the pitcher from Brianna. She actually tried to hold on to it for a moment, frowning at him as if she would deny him a drink, and poured for himself before handing it back. She snatched the pitcher out of his hand.
"Now, what happened? What about these white cloaks?"
"I sent Rocken out scouting as far as they could go just before dawn, and again just after sunset. One of the flyers tonight turned back sooner than expected. She saw 7,000 children of the light on the move not 50 miles from my camp."
"On the move toward you?"
Perrin frowned at his wine instead of drinking.
7,000 seems a very exact count to make in the dark."
"It seems these men, they're deserters," Anura broke in. "At least the Banner General sees them so."
In gray silk, she appeared as neat as if she had spent an hour dressing. Her thrusting nose made her look like a crow wearing beaded braids as she peered at Tylee, and the Banner General, a particularly interesting bit of carrion.
She held a wine cup, but it seemed untouched.
"I have heard rumors that Pedron Nile died fighting the Seanchan, but apparently Iman Valda, who replaced Nile, swore fealty to the Seanchan Empress."
Tylee mouthed, "May she live forever," under her breath. Perrin doubted anyone but himself heard. Balwer opened his mouth too, but closed it again without speaking. The white cloaks were a bugbear to him.
"Something over a month ago, however," the Grey Sister went on, "Galad Damodred killed Valda and led 7,000 white cloaks to leave the Seanchan cause. A pity he became enmeshed with white cloaks, but perhaps some good has come of it. In any case, it appears there is a standing order that these men are all to be killed as soon as found. I have summed it up nicely, yes, Banner General?"
Tylee's hand twitched, as if it wanted to make one of those signs against evil.
"That's a fair summing up," she said.
To Perrin, not Anura. The Seanchan woman seemed to find speaking to an Aes Sedai difficult.
"Except the part about good coming of it. Oath-breaking and desertion can never be called good."
"I take it they're not moving toward you, or you'd have said."
Perrin put a hint of question into that, though there was no question in his mind.
North, Tylee answered. They're heading north.
Balwer half opened his mouth again, then shut it with a click of teeth.
If you have advice, Perrin told him, then give it. But I don't care how many white cloaks desert the Seanchan. Fael is the only thing I care about. And I don't think the Banner General will give up the chance to collar 300 or 400 more Damani to chase after them.
Berylaine grimaced. Honora's face remained smooth, but she took a long swallow of her wine. None of the Aes Sedai felt very complacent about that part of the plan. None of the wise ones did either.
"I will not," Tylee said firmly. "I think I'll take some wine after all."
Brianna took a deep breath before moving to comply, and a hint of fear entered her scent. Apparently, the tall, dark woman intimidated her.
"I won't deny I would enjoy a chance to strike a blow at the White Cloaks," Balwer said in that dry-as-dust voice. "But in truth, I feel I owe this Galad Damodred a debt of gratitude."
Perhaps his grudge was against this Valda personally.
"In any case, you have no need of my advice here. Events are in motion in Mulden, and if they weren't, I doubt you'd hold back even a day."
"Nor would I have advised it, my lord. If I may be so bold, I am quite fond of the Lady Fael."
"You may," Perrin told him. "Banner General, you said 2 pieces of news."
The Seanchan took the proffered wine cup from Brianna, and looked at him so levelly it was clear she was avoiding a glance at the others in the tent.
"May we speak alone?" she asked quietly.
Berylaine glided across the carpet to rest a hand on his arm and smile up at him.
"Honora and I don't mind leaving," she said.
Light, how could anyone believe there was anything between him and her? She was as beautiful as ever, true, yet the scent that had minded him of a hunting cat was so long gone from her smell that he barely remembered it. The bedrock of her scent was patience and resolve now. She had come to accept that he loved Fael and only Fael, and she seemed as determined to see Fael freed as he was.
"You can stay," he said. "Whatever you have to say, Banner General, you can say in front of everyone here."
Tylee hesitated, glancing at Honora.
"There are 2 large parties of Aiel heading toward Mulden," she said at last, reluctantly. "One to the southeast, one to the southwest. The Morat Rakan estimate they could be there in 3 days."
Suddenly everything seemed to ripple in Perrin's sight. He felt himself ripple. Brianna gave a cry and dropped the pitcher. The world rippled again, and Berylaine clutched his arm. Tylee's hand seemed frozen in that odd gesture, thumb and forefinger forming a crescent. Everything rippled for a third time, and Perrin felt as if he were made of fog, as if the world were fog with a high wind coming. Berylaine shuddered, and he put a comforting arm around her. She clung to him, trembling. Silence and the scent of fear filled the tent. He could hear voices being raised outside, and they sounded afraid, too.
"What was that?" Tylee demanded finally.
"I don't know."
Honora's face remained serene, but her voice was unsteady.
"Light, I have no idea."
"It doesn't matter what it was," Perrin told them. He ignored their stares. "In 3 days, it will all be over. That's all that matters. Fael was all that mattered."
The sun stood short of its noonday peak, but Fael already felt harassed. The water for Savannah's morning bath, she bathed twice a day now, had not been hot enough, and Fael had been beaten along with everyone else, although she and Alejandra had only been there to scrub the woman's back. More than 20 wetlander Guy Shine had begged to be allowed to swear fealty just since sunrise. 3 had suggested rising up, pointing out that there were more Guy Shine in all these tents than Shido. They had seemed to listen when she pointed out that nearly all of the Aiel knew how to use a spear, while most of the wetlanders were farmers or craftsfolk. Few had ever held a weapon, and fewer still used one. They had seemed to listen, but this was the first day anyone had suggested such a thing right after swearing, Usually they took several days to work themselves around to it. The pressure was building, toward a slaughter unless she could thwart it. And now this. "It is only a game, Fail Bashir," Roland said, towering over her as they walked along one of the muddy streets that wound through the Shido tents. He sounded amused, and a very small smile curved his lips. A beautiful man, to be sure. "A kissing game, you said?" She shifted the lengths of striped toweling folded over her arm to draw his attention. "I have work to do, and no time for games, especially kissing games." She could see a few Aiel, several of them men staggering drunk even at this hour, but most of the people in the street were wetlanders wearing dirty Gaishine robes, or children splashing happily in the mud puddles left by the night's heavy rain. The street was thronged with men and women in mud-stained white carrying baskets or buckets or pots. Some actually went about chores. There were so many Gaishine in the camp that there really was not enough work to go around. That would not stop a Shido from ordering what were seen as idle hands to some work or other if those hands stuck out of white sleeves, however, even if it was make-work. To avoid having to dig useless holes in muddy fields, or scrub pots that were already clean, a good many of the Gaishine had taken to carrying something that made them look as if they were working. That did not help anyone avoid the real work, but it did help avert the other kind. Fail did not have to worry about that with most of the Shido, not so long as she wore those thick golden chains around her waist and neck, but the necklace and belt were inadequate for deterring wise ones. She had scrubbed clean pots for some of them, and sometimes had been punished for not being available when Savannah wanted her. Thus the toweling.
"We could start with a kissing game children play," he said, "though the forfeits in that are sometimes embarrassing. In the game adults play, the forfeits are fun. Losing can be as pleasant as winning."
She could not help laughing. The man certainly was persistent. Suddenly she saw Galena hurrying through the crowd in her direction, holding her white silk robes up out of the mud, eyes searching avidly. Fail had heard the woman was allowed clothing again as of this morning. Of course, she had never been without the tall necklace and wide belt of gold and fire drops. A cap of hair less than an inch long covered her head, and of all things a large red bow was pinned in it. It seemed unlikely that was by the woman's choice. Only a face Fail could not put an age to convinced her that Galena really was Aes Sedai. Beyond that, she was unsure of anything about her except the danger she presented. Galena spotted her and stopped dead, hands kneading her robes. The Aes Sedai eyed Roland uncertainly. "I'll have to think on it, Roland." She was not about to chase him away until she was sure of Galena. "I need time to think."
"Women always want time to think. Think on forgetting your troubles in the pleasure of a harmless game."
The finger he drew softly down her cheek before walking away made her shiver. To Aiel, touching someone's cheek in public was as much as a kiss. It surely had felt like a kiss to her. Harmless? Somehow she doubted that any game that involved kissing Roland would end with just kissing. Luckily, she would not have to find out, or hide anything from Perrin, if Galena proved true. If. The Aes Sedai darted to her as soon as Roland was gone. "Where is it?" Galena demanded, seizing her arm. "Tell me! I know you have it! You must have it!" The woman sounded almost pleading. Thurava's treatment of her had shattered that fabled Aes Sedai composure. Fail shook off her grip. "First, tell me again that you will take my friends and me with you when you go. Tell me straight out, and tell me when you are going." "Don't you dare talk to me that way," Galena hissed. Fail saw black flecks floating in her vision before she realized that she had been slapped. To her surprise, she slapped the other woman back as hard as she could, staggering her. She refrained from putting a hand to her stinging face, but Galena rubbed her own cheek, her eyes wide with shock. Fail steeled herself, perhaps for a blow with the power or something worse, but nothing happened. Some of the passing Gaishine stared at them, but none stopped or even slowed. Anything that looked like a gathering of Gaishine would draw Shido eyes and earn punishments for everyone involved. "Tell me," she said again. I will take you and your friends with me, Galena practically snarled, snatching her hand down. I leave tomorrow, if you have it. If not, Savannah will know who you are within the hour. Well, that was certainly speaking straight out. It's hidden in the town. I'll get it for you now. But as she turned, Galena grabbed her arm again. The Aes Sedai's eyes darted, and she lowered her voice as if suddenly concerned about being overheard. She sounded frightened. No, I'll take no chances on anyone seeing. You'll give it to me tomorrow morning, in the town. We'll meet there, in the south end of the town. I'll mark the building with a red scarf. Fael blinked. The southern half of Malden was a burned-out shell. Why there? She asked incredulously. Because no one goes there, fool. Because no one will see us. Galena's eyes were still darting. Tomorrow morning, early. Fail me and you'll regret it. Gathering the skirts of her silk robe, she scurried away into the crowd. Fael frowned as she watched the woman go. She should have felt exultation, but she did not. Galena seemed almost a wild thing, unpredictable. Still, Aes Sedai could not lie. There seemed no way for her to wriggle out of her promise. And if she found one, there were still her own plans for an escape, though those seemed no further along, if much more dangerous, than they had when first begun. Which left Rolan and his kissing games. Galena had to prove true. She had to.
Chapter 27. A Plain Wooden Box. The midday Altaran sun was warm, though a gusting breeze sometimes whipped Rand's cloak. They had been on the hilltop for 2 hours now. A great mass of dark clouds creeping down from the north above blue-gray haze spoke of rain to come, and a cooling. Andor lay only a few miles in that direction, across low forested hills of oak and pine, leatherleaf and sour gum. That border had seen countless generations of cattle raids going in both directions. Was Elaine watching it rain in Camelin? That lay a good 150 leagues east, too far for her to be more than a faint presence in the back of his head. Avienda in Ara-Daman was fainter still. He had not considered that the Wise Ones would take her along. Still, she would be safe among tens of thousands of Aiel, as safe as Elaine behind Camelin's walls. Tidashar stamped a hoof and tossed his head, eager to be moving. Rand patted the big black's neck. The stallion could reach the border in under an hour, but their way was west today. A short way west, in just a short while now. He had to impress at today's meeting, and he had chosen his garb with care. The crown of swords sat on his head for more reason than making an impression, though. Half the small swords nestled among the wide band of laurel leaves, pointed down, making it uncomfortable to wear, giving constant reminders of its weight, in gold, and in responsibility. A small chip in one of those laurel leaves dug at his temple to remind him of the battle against the Seanchan, where it had been made. A battle lost, where he could not afford to lose. His dark green silk coat was embroidered in gold on the sleeves, shoulders, and high collar. A gold inlaid buckle in the shape of a dragon fastened his sword belt, and he had the dragon's scepter in hand, a 2-foot length of spearhead with a long green and white tassel below the polished steel point. If the Daughter of the Nine Moons recognized it for part of a Seanchan spear, she must also see the dragons that maidens had carved winding around the remaining haft. Today he wore no gloves. The golden-maned dragon heads on the backs of his hands glittered metallically in the sun. However high she stood among the Seanchan, she would know whom she faced.
A fool!
Luz Theron's wild laughter echoed inside his head.
A fool to walk into a trap!
Rand ignored the madman. It might be a trap, but he was ready to spring it if it was. It was worth the risk. He needed his truce. He could crush the Seanchan, but at what cost in blood and in time he might not have. He glanced north again. The sky above Andor was clear except for a few high white clouds, drifting wisps. The last battle was coming. He had to take the risk. Min, toying with the reins of her gray mare nearby, was feeling smug and that irritated him. She had inveigled a promise from him in a weak moment and refused to release him. He could just break it. He should break it. As if she had heard his thoughts, she looked at him. Her face, surrounded by dark shoulder-length ringlets, was smooth, but the bond suddenly carried suspicion and hints of anger. She seemed to be trying to suppress both, yet she adjusted the cuffs of her ornately embroidered red coat the way she did when checking her knives. Of course she would not use one of those blades on him. Of course not.
"A woman's love can be violent," Luz Theron murmured. "Sometimes they hurt a man worse than they think they have, worse than they mean to. Sometimes they're even sorry afterwards."
He sounded sane for the moment, but Rand shoved the voice down.
"You should let us scout further out, Randall Thor," Nandera said. She and the 24 other maidens on the sparsely wooded hilltop wore their black veils up. Some had their bows in hand and arrows nocked. The rest of the maidens were among the trees, well out from the hill, keeping watch against unpleasant surprises.
"The land is clear all the way to the manor house, but this still smells of a trap to me."
There had been a time when words like manor and house sounded awkward on her tongue. She had been a long time in the wetlands now, though.
"Nandera speaks truth," Olivia muttered sullenly, heeling her roan gelding closer.
Apparently the golden-haired woman still resented the fact that she would not be going with him, but her reaction to hearing her native accents in Tyr made that impossible. She admitted having been shaken, but claimed it had been the surprise of the thing. He could not chance it, though.
"You cannot trust any of the high blood, especially a daughter of the Empress, may she—"
Her mouth snapped shut, and she smoothed her dark blue skirts unnecessarily, grimacing at what she had almost said. He trusted her, literally with his life, but she had too many deep-buried instincts to risk putting her face to face with the woman he was going to meet. The bond carried anger with no effort to suppress it now. Min disliked seeing Olivia near him.
"It smells of a trap to me, too," Bashir said, easing his sinuously curved sword in its scabbard.
He was plainly clad in burnished helmet and breastplate, his gray silk coat alone marking him out from the 81 Saldaean lancers arrayed around the hilltop. His thick, down-curved mustaches almost bristled behind the face bars of his helmet.
"I'd give 10,000 crowns to know how many soldiers she has out there, and how many demoni. This daughter of the Nine Moons is the heir to their throne, man."
He had been shocked when Olivia revealed that. No one in Abu Dhar had mentioned it to him, as if it were of no importance.
"They may claim their control ends far south of here, but you can wager she has at least a small army to see her to safety."
"And if our scouts find this army," Rand replied calmly, "can we be sure they won't be seen?"
Nandera made a scornful sound.
"Best not to assume you're the only one with eyes," he told her. "If they think we're planning to attack them or kidnap the woman, everything falls apart."
Maybe that was why they had kept their secret. The imperial heir would be a more tempting target for a kidnapping than a mere high-ranking noblewoman.
"You just keep watch to make sure they don't catch us by surprise. If it all goes wrong, Bashir, you know what to do. Besides, she may have an army, but so do I, and not so small."
Bashir had to nod at that. Aside from the Saldaeans and the maidens, the hilltop was crowded with Ashaman and Aes Sedai and warders, better than 25 all told, and as formidable a group as any small army. They mingled with surprising ease and few outward signs of tension.
Otovain, a short, coppery-skinned red, was scowling at Loghain, but Gabrella, a dusky brown with sooty green eyes, was talking with him quite companionably, perhaps even coquettishly.
That might have been the reason for Tovain's scowl, though disapproval seemed more likely than jealousy.
Adriel and Curran each had an arm around the other's waist, though she was tall enough to overtop the Damani Ashaman, and beautiful where he was plain and had gray at his temples. Not to mention that he had bonded the gray against her will.
Beldine knew enough to the shawl that she simply looked like any young Saldaean woman, with slightly tilted brown eyes, reached out every now and then to touch man for, and he smiled at her whenever she did. Her bonding of him had been a shock, but apparently the yellow-haired man had been more than willing. Neither had asked Rand his opinion before the bonding. Strangest of all, perhaps, was Genera, pale and sturdy in a gray riding dress embroidered with red on the skirts, and Kajima, a clerkish fellow in his middle years who wore his hair like Narishma, in two braids with silver bells at the ends. She laughed at something Kajima said, and murmured something that made him laugh in turn. A red, joking with a man who could channel? Maybe Taim had effected a change for the better, whatever he had intended. And maybe Randall Thor was living in a dream, too. Aes Sedai were famous for their dissembling. But could a red dissemble that far? Not everyone felt agreeable today. Ayako's eyes seemed almost black as she glared at Rand, but then, considering what happened to a warder when his Aes Sedai died, the dark-complected little white had reason to fear Sandomir going into possible danger. The Ashaman bond differed from the warder bond in some respects, but in others it was identical, and no one yet knew the effects of an Ashaman's death on the woman he had bonded. Elsa was frowning at Rand, too, one hand on the shoulder of her tall, lean warder, Firo, as if she were gripping a guard dog's collar and thinking of losing him. Not against Rand, certainly, but he worried for anyone she thought might be threatening him. He had given her orders about that, and her oath should see them obeyed. Yet Aes Sedai could find loopholes in almost anything. Maerys was speaking firmly to Narishma, with her two other warders sitting their horses a little way off. There was no mistaking the way the stern-faced woman gestured as she spoke, leaning close to him so she could speak in a low voice. She was instructing him about something. Rand disliked that in the circumstances, yet there seemed little he could do. Maerys had sworn no oaths, and she would ignore him when it came to one of her warders. Or much of anything else, for that matter. Cadswain was watching Rand, too. She and Nynaeve were wearing all of their Tirangrial jewelry. Nynaeve was making a good try at Aes Sedai calm. She seemed to practice that a great deal since sending Lan wherever she had sent him. Half the hilltop separated her plump brown mare from Cadswain's bay, of course. Nynaeve would never admit it, but Cadswain intimidated her. Loghain rode up between Rand and Bashir, his black gelding prancing. The horse was almost the exact shade of his coat and cloak. "The sun is almost straight overhead," he said. "Time we go down?" There was only a mere hint of question in that. The man chafed at taking orders. He did not wait on a reply.
"Sandomir!" he called loudly. "Narishma!"
Maerys held Narishma by his sleeve for another moment of instructions before letting him ride over, which made Loghain scowl. Sundark Narishma, with his dark, belled braids, looked years younger than Rand, though he was a few years older in truth. Sitting his dun as straight as a sword, he nodded to Loghain as to an equal, producing another scowl. Sandomir spoke a quiet word to Ayako before mounting his dapple, and she touched his thigh once he was in the saddle. Wrinkled, with receding hair and a gray-streaked beard trimmed to a point and oiled, he made her appear youthful rather than ageless. He wore the red and gold dragon on his high black collar now, as well as the silver sword. Every Ashaman on the hill did, even Manfor. He had only recently been raised to dedicated, but he had been one of the first to come to the Black Tower, before there was a Black Tower. Most of the men who had begun with him were dead. Even Loghain had not denied he deserved it. Loghain had enough sense not to call Cadswain or Nynaeve, but they rode to join Rand anyway, placing themselves to either side of him, each briefly eyeing him, faces so smooth they might have been thinking anything. Their eyes met, and Nynaeve looked away quickly. Cadswain gave a faint snort. And Min came, too, his one more to balance the honors. A man should never give promises in bed. He opened his mouth, and she arched an eyebrow, looking at him very directly. The bond felt full of something dangerous.
"You stay behind me once we get there," he told her, not at all what he had intended to say.
Danger faded to what he had come to recognize as love. There was wry amusement in the bond, too, for some reason.
"I will if I want to, you wool-headed sheep-herder," she said with more than a little asperity, just as if the bond would not tell him her true feelings.
hard as those might be to decipher.
"If we're going to do this fool thing, let's get it done with," Cadswain said firmly, and heeled her dark bay down the hill.
A short distance from the hill, farms began to appear along a meandering dirt road through the forest, hard packed by long years of use, but still carrying a slick of mud from the last rainfall. The chimneys of thatched stone houses smoked with the midday meal cooking. Sometimes girls and women sat out in the sun at their spinning wheels. Men in rough coats walked in the stone-walled fields, checking their sprouting crops amid boys hoeing weeds. The pastures held brown and white cattle or black-tailed sheep, usually watched by a boy or two with bows or slings. There were wolves in these forests, and leopards and other things that enjoyed the taste of beef and mutton. Some people shaded their eyes to peer at the passers-by, doubtless wondering who these finely dressed folk were who had come to visit the Lady Deirdre. Surely there could be no other reason for their presence, heading toward the manor house and so far from anywhere important. No one seemed agitated or frightened, though, just going about their day's work. Rumors of an army in the region surely would have upset them, and rumors of that sort spread like wildfire. Strange. The Shan Shan could not travel and arrive without news speeding ahead of them. It was very strange. He felt Loghain and the other two men seize Sayadin, filling themselves with it. Loghain held almost as much as he could have himself, Narishma and Sandomir somewhat less. They were the strongest among the other Ashaman, though, and both had been at Dumai's Wells. Loghain had proven he could handle himself in other places, other battles. If this was a trap, they would be ready, and the other side would never know it until too late. Rand did not reach for the source. He could feel Luz Theron lurking in his head. This was no time to give the madman a chance to get hold of the power.
"Cadswain, Nynaeve, you'd better embrace the source now," he said. "We're getting close."
"I've been holding Sidar since back on that hill," Nynaeve told him.
Cadswain snorted and gave him a look that called him an idiot. Rand stilled a grimace before it could begin. His skin felt no tingling, no goosebumps. They had masked their ability, and with it shielded him from sensing the power in them. Men had had few advantages over women when it came to channeling, but now they had lost those few, while women retained all of theirs. Some of the Ashaman were trying to puzzle out how to duplicate what Nacella had created, to find a weave that would allow men to detect women's weaves, but so far without success. Well, it would have to be dealt with by someone else. He had all he could manage on his plate at the moment. The farms continued, some alone in a clearing, others clustered three or four or five together. If they followed the road far enough, they would reach the village of King's Crossing in a few miles, where a wooden bridge spanned a narrow river called the Rashal. But well short of that, the road passed by a large clearing marked by a pair of tall stone gateposts, though there were neither gates nor fence. 100 paces or more beyond it, at the end of a mud-slicked clay lane, lay Lady Deirdre's manor. 2 stories of thatch-roofed gray stone, saved from looking a large farmhouse only by the gateposts and the tall, twinned doors at the front. The stables and outbuildings had the same practical appearance, sturdy and unornamented. There was no one in sight, no stableman, no servant on her way to fetch eggs, no men in the fields that flanked the lane. The house's tall chimneys stood smokeless. It did smell of a trap. But the countryside was quiet, the farmers unruffled. There was only one way to find out. Rand turned Tadaishar in through the gateposts, and the others followed. Min did not heed his warning. She pushed her gray in between Tadaishar and Nynaeve's mare and grinned at him. The bond carried nervousness, but the woman grinned. When he was halfway to the house, the doors opened and 2 women came out. One in dark gray, the other in blue, with red panels on her breast, and ankle-length skirts. Sunlight glinted off the silvery leash connecting them. 2 more appeared, and 2 more, until 3 pairs stood in a row to either side of the door. As he reached the 3/4 point, another woman stepped into the doorway, very dark and very small, dressed in pleated white, her head covered by a transparent scarf that fell over her face. The daughter of the 9 moons. She had been described to Bashir right down to her shaven head.
A tension in his shoulders he had not been aware of melted. That she was actually here did away with the possibility of a trap. The Shanchen would not risk the heir to their throne in anything so dangerous. He drew rein and dismounted. "One of them is channeling," Nynaeve said, just loudly enough for him to hear as she climbed down from her saddle. "I can't see anything, so she's masked her ability and inverted the weave, and I wonder how the Shanchen learned that. But she's channeling. Only one. There isn't enough for it to be two." Her Tirangrial could not tell whether it was Sayadin or Sayadar being channeled, but it was unlikely to be a man.
"I told you it was a trap," Luz Theron groaned. "I told you."
Rand pretended to check his saddle girth. "Can you tell which one?" he asked quietly. He still did not reach for Sayadin. There was no telling what Luz Theron might do in these circumstances if he managed to grab control again. Loghain was fiddling with his girth, too, and Narishma was watching Sandomir check one of the Dapple's hooves. They had heard. The small woman was waiting in the doorway, very still, but no doubt impatient and likely offended by their apparent interest in their horses.
"No," Cadswain replied grimly, "but I can do something about it, once we're closer."
Her golden hair ornaments swayed as she tossed her cloak back as though unmasking a sword.
"Stay behind me," he told Min, and to his relief she nodded.
Her face wore a small frown, and the bond carried worry. Not fear, though. She knew he would protect her. Leaving the horses standing, he started toward the Suldam and Damani, with Cadswain and Nynaeve a little distance to either side of him. Loghain, hand resting on his sword hilt, as if that were his real weapon, strode along on the other side of Cadswain, Narishma and Sandomir, beyond Nynaeve. The small dark woman began walking toward them slowly, holding her pleated skirts up off the damp ground. Abruptly, no more than 10 paces away, she flickered. For an instant she was taller than most men, garbed all in black, surprise on her face, and though she still wore the veil, her head was covered with short-cut wavy black hair. Only an instant before the small woman returned, her step faltering as she let her white skirts fall, but another flicker, and the tall dark woman stood there, her face twisted in fury behind the veil. He recognized that face, though he had never seen it before. Luz Theron had, and that was enough.
"Semirog," he said in shock before he could stop the word, and suddenly everything seemed to happen at once.
He reached for the source and found Luz Theron clawing for it too, each of them jostling the other aside from reaching it. Semirog flicked her hand, and a small ball of fire streaked toward him from her fingertips. She might have shouted something, an order. He could not leap aside. Min stood right behind him. Frantically trying to seize Sayadin, he flung up the hand holding the dragon scepter in desperation. The world seemed to explode in fire. His cheek was pressed against the damp ground, he realized. Black flecks shimmered in his vision, and everything seemed faintly hazy, as if seen through water. Where was he? What had happened? His head felt stuffed with wool. Something was prodding him in the ribs. His sword hilt. The old wounds were a hard knot of pain just above that. Slowly, he realized he was looking at the dragon scepter, or what was left of it. The spear point and a few inches of charred haft lay 3 paces away. Small dancing flames were consuming the long tassel. The crown of swords lay beyond it. Abruptly, it came to him that he could feel Sayadin being channeled. His skin was goosebumps all over from Sayadar being wielded. The manor house. Semirog! He tried to push himself up and collapsed with a harsh cry. Slowly, he pulled a left arm that seemed all pain up where he could see his hand. See where his hand had been. Only a mangled, blackened ruin remained. A stub sticking out of a cuff that gave off thin streamers of smoke. But the power was still being channeled around him. His people were fighting for their lives. They might be dying. Min! He struggled to rise and fell again. As though thinking of her had summoned her, Min was crouching over him, trying to shield him with her body, he realized. The bond was full of compassion and pain. Not physical pain. He would have known if she had the smallest injury. She was feeling pain for him.
"Lie still," she said.
You've been hurt.
I know, he said hoarsely. Again he reached for Sayadine, and for a wonder, this time Lutheran did not try to interfere. The power filled him, and that gave him the strength to push himself to his feet one-handed, preparing several very nasty weaves as he did so. Careless of his muddy coat, Min gripped his good arm as though she were trying to hold him upright. But the fighting was over. Semirag was standing stiffly with her arms at her sides, her skirts pressed against her legs, doubtless wrapped up in flows of air. The hilt of one of Min's knives stood out from her shoulder, and she must have been shielded too, but her dark, beautiful face was contemptuous. She had been a prisoner before, briefly, during the War of the Shadow. She had escaped from high detention by frightening her jailers to the point that they actually smuggled her to freedom. Others had been injured more seriously. A short, dark Suldam and tall, pale-haired Domani, linked by an Edam, lay sprawled on the ground, staring up at the sun with already glazed eyes, and another pair were on their knees and clinging to one another, blood running down their faces and matting their hair. The other pairs stood as stiffly as Semirag, and he could see the shields on three of the Domani. They looked stunned. One of the Suldam, a slender, dark-haired young woman, was weeping softly. Narishma's face was bloodied, too, and his coat appeared singed. So did Sandomir's, and a bone jutted through his left coat sleeve, white smeared with red, until Nynaeve firmly pulled his arm straight and guided the bone back into place. Grimacing in pain, he gave a guttural groan. She cupped her hands around his arm over the break, and moments later he was flexing his arm and moving his fingers and murmuring thanks. Loghain appeared untouched, as did Nynaeve and Cadswain, who was studying Semirag the way a brown might study an exotic animal never before seen. Suddenly gateways began opening all around the manor house, spilling out mounted Ashaman and Aes Sedai and warders, veiled maidens and Bashir riding at the head of his horsemen. An Ashaman and Aes Sedai in a ring of two could make a gateway considerably larger than those Rand could alone. So someone had managed to give the signal. A red sunburst in the sky. Every Ashaman was full of Sayadine, and Rand assumed the Aes Sedai were equally full of Sayadar. The maidens began spreading out into the trees.
Agan! Hamad! Search the house! Bashir shouted. Matun! Form the lancers! They'll be on us as soon as they can!
Two soldiers thrust their lances into the ground and leapt down to run inside, drawing their swords, while the others began arraying themselves in two ranks. Ayako flung herself from her saddle and rushed to Sandomir, not even bothering to hold her skirts out of the mud. Maris rode to Narishma before swinging down right in front of him and taking his head in her hands without a word. He jerked, his back arching and nearly pulling his head free as she healed him. She had little facility with Nynaeve's method of healing,